So I think I have 10 seconds. Let's see. Okay, I'll end it with this. I think the title of my paper was Feminist Transformation and Human Rights Activism in the Americas. And I think in order to actually fully appreciate that the feminist transformations that have happened, particularly around around discourses of anti-racism, we have to look at this conference in 1945. It's incredibly rich in terms of the trajectory that I was able to sort of unpack a little bit, and I'm still very much so early on in the unpacking of it. But I've tried to think about it as not as efforts to dismiss what they were doing there, in particular because these were women who were in positions of privilege, but essentially to offer a more, or to think through a more complicated narrative of feminist movements emerging at this time in a much smaller scale, and then ultimately produce sort of new opportunities for, I think, feminists today.
Thank you.
Yeah, we can turn that off now.
Okay.
No.
I'm not going to offer a critique of the papers individually, partly because I feel a little chastened by Bertha Lutz saying that men like to hear themselves talk.
As opposed to me.
Right. But, and also because I expect to make those kind of individual critiques when I accompany the referee reports in my accept with revision notice in the Journal of Human Rights to both of you when you send these in. So I'll just make a couple comments about how I think they fit together. Both of these papers make a similar case about how either local or sort of disempowered groups affect both the definition of human rights and the conceptual development of human rights, either within institutions like the UN or within particular cultures like Indonesia. So they both present stories about how very early on, here we're talking about the 1940s again, where is Sam Moyn? Very early on, beginning in the 1940s, the indivisibility thesis, which hasn't even been named yet among human rights scholars, that claims that there's no separation between political and civil rights and social and economic and cultural rights, that already by the 1940s, that was being recognized and invoked by some human rights actors. Now, the papers are interestingly different in that Silvana explicitly calls the indivisibility thesis a feminist principle, I would like to explore a little bit. Whereas after reading Brad's paper, it's clear why it really is an Indonesian idea, not a feminist idea, or maybe just a developing world idea. But the really interesting lesson, I think, to take away from both the papers is how the role of power, or maybe even more interestingly, powerlessness, in the movement to include social and economic rights within, indivisibly within the corpus of human rights, what the role of powerlessness is in the sense that it's a very interesting and general story played out both within many developing countries and by women, both within those developing countries and in Silvana's paper in early human rights institutions, that really emerges as kind of paradoxical, even ironic, at least very interesting thesis that both papers put forward. That this conceptual convergence is being played out locally by essentially people who are without power. And 30 years later, the rest of us finally get around to recognizing it. So I'll just throw that out there, and I don't know if you want to respond. I thought we would open it up for questions first, and then you can respond to the questions and to whatever else. Okay, that didn't work.
Other questions?
Silvana, I've often wondered when we tell our students about the pressure from the Latin American states at the League conference. Mm-hmm. This has been part of this master narrative that there were these various conferences, the Mexico City conference.
Mm-hmm.
This fascinates me because this is one of these other audible voices predating 1945.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Latin America is sort of on the periphery of the war and so on. And what I've often wondered is, what is the social and class background of the women going to these conferences? Do they resemble more Eleanor Roosevelt, that they were part of local suffrage struggles or national struggles? Are they primarily of European origin rather than of indigenous origin, and you know, what are the intersections of their class background with this call for rights? I mean, where does it come from for them? And where it might come from the American NGOs and so on, out of gender and racial struggle. Where's it coming from in this Latin American conference, and why this great conference in Mexico City of all places? And of course, Argentina doesn't like this, but that's certainly one.
Well, you know, when I did some research, a little bit more digging on the four women who signed the UN Charter, I mean, it's very clear that these are very privileged women, and oftentimes running in mostly the same circles as the men who attended the conference, and it makes sense. I mean, they're on official government delegations. That doesn't happen just because they happen to be an indigenous woman who is, in fact, challenging the state. In a lot of ways, they are very much so part and parcel of not challenging the state in the way that we would think that women might in fact do today who enter the UN space. So part of what I talk about when I look at the United Women's Conference as well, where I talk a little bit more, I unpack a little bit more their biographies, is that that there's real blinders here in terms of having a racial consciousness, for instance. There was very little, if any, mention of racial oppression in the United Women's Conference. And the only time race sort of entered into play is with a declaration that had been sent by the delegation of Haiti to the women at the conference
Frangoulis
at the time. Pardon me?
Well, Frangoulis was the one.
Right. So I think very much so in terms of a social circle, they're not that much different than the men in terms of having elements of privilege. But nonetheless, there was a great number of instances where men were very, very, who were part of UNCIO, were very frustrated by just the four women out of the hundreds, right, of delegates that were there, because they really took on trying to figure out the role of women in this newly formed institution. And when they started making, suggestions about having quotas of some sort so that women would be secured in particular positions to set the agenda at the UN, there was, instant sort of pushback on that.